special program. There's no line one today, so we're going to be jumping right out of this program at a minute before 10, so we can join that. On video conference we have today, Dr. Theobald Shanna, thank you, from the Kodiak Ambulatory Care Clinic, who's now in quarantine. Wow. What a way to start a show.
Right.
Friday the 13th apparently was not a kind day to us. Right? For those who don't know, you've contracted the virus. So now you can give us some firsthand information about what it is and what it does and how maybe you got it. And maybe some tips on how we can try and stay away from it, because you, of all people, it would seem, you know what you can do, you know all the protocols, but you know you're there susceptible to this. So just before we went on the air, you said you thought it was almost inevitable that it was going to happen.
Yeah.
I was really unhappy to hear that. So good morning.
Good morning.
It's really nice to see your smiling face without a mask on.
That is the benefits of being
of having COVID. Yeah, that's the benefit of having COVID. Oh Lord.
As you said, Friday the 13th is probably when my husband had a known exposure to a passenger that he was flying. He was wearing a mask, but on those little airplanes, you're within 6 feet for at least probably 15, 20, 25 minutes. And who knows? I mean, it doesn't take much. And he was in the isolation. We were really trying to isolate, but then I had some things come up where it was just hard for us to isolate. So, could have I avoided getting it? Probably, if we could have been extremely careful and not. You know, he stayed locked in the room and I brought him food, decontaminated everything, and I wore a mask all the time. But anyway, we ended up not isolating as well as we know we would have in any other kind of time or situation. But with both of us being in high risk professions where we are around people and we're within close proximity of people and we can't work from home, he's a pilot and obviously I work at the clinic, we kind of, chances that we were going to get it eventually are pretty high. And so here we are.
Here we are. But what was really interesting is you were asymptomatic and this was a surprise to you that you had it, right?
He tested negative 5 days out and then was told, to continue in isolation until at least 10 days. And, we talked about the ideal period being 14 days. But on day 6 or 7 after the exposure, it was a week after the exposure, I got a screening test on Friday and was asymptomatic, not expecting it to be positive at all. And we got the call that it was positive. And that night we both got just hit hard with symptoms, like we both got destroyed. No, it was really like a really bad, really bad flu where body aches, fever, chills, just feeling really like what we call malaise in medicine, which is just that really icky, crummy feeling that you get with the flu. And then I had really violent vomiting that was painful and splitting headache. It just feels like there's a metal boring through your eye in the back of your head, which I read is very common with COVID. A lot of headaches and persistent headaches after the virus resolves are second to fever. And then we had a few days later, yesterday, we both have no taste. And we cannot taste any foods, which is really bizarre, and can't really smell anything. But our symptoms are overall, like after the first day and a half to 2 days, everything kind of improved. Our symptoms got better. There's still a little bit just like, achy, feeling run down. Can't taste anything, congestion, cough. But overall, we're on the mend. so far, knock on wood.
Yeah. Well, you identified it. I mean, was there an awareness on the 13th? I mean, did you just go back in time and sort of recreate when he had exposure to a person you thought was infected?
Yeah, he was told on Saturday. Luckily, it wasn't through public health, and I think public health is pretty far behind on contact tracing right now. We finally did get a call maybe 5 or 6 days later. I got a call. My husband actually never did get a call from public health and wasn't aware. But luckily, through, you know, Kodiak's grapevine, they found out that that person, the passenger he flew, was positive. So Island Air had him come home in quarantine, which was great. Island Air is doing a really good job. They're all masking and, you know, kind of taking the quarantines and the exposure seriously. But that was the known exposure that we had, and seems most likely because it was, you know, it meets, he was in a close confined space with a positive person who I don't think was wearing a mask. I don't think they knew they were positive when they flew. I think they found out after, whether they got those, you know, the tests that resulted after they took the flight. But I don't know this. I don't know the details on that side. All I know is that he had been told by his boss that he had flown a positive passenger on Saturday. So he went into quarantine on Saturday. And luckily he had that much information because it could have been all unknown, you know?
Yeah. So it always seemed weird to me that if you ran into that situation and if you're in a small plane and you're in a 45-50 minute flight, that didn't make any difference if you have a mask on, but did the passenger have a mask on?
I don't think so. Dr. Zink actually gave a really good talk, and there was some cases on commercial airlines, which have, you know, the HEPA filter system more than our small, you know, the small little planes, but that there were a lot of case where they kind of did retrospective case reviews that people that were on the plane and had a mask on with another positive passenger were much less likely to contract COVID. I think it was like a 50 to 70%, you know, of the cases that they looked at did not contract COVID compared to those that weren't masked. But that is, yeah, in a small plane, I agree with you. A mask, especially, and if it's an N95, it's likely, you know, to filter and it fits well and you've been fitted for it. There's no gaps. You're probably 95% safe because that's what that 95 is. Basically, it filters 95% of the smallest particles that, you know, the viral size particles. But in this, yeah, if you're wearing a surgical mask or a cloth mask and you're in that close contact, there's very good chance that those viral particles will pass through that mask some point during that duration.
Wow. So what's the trickle down effect to you in the clinic then? I mean, what, obviously, if you're asymptomatic and you're in contact with people at the clinic, you have protocols in place so that you're not going to pass things back and forth. But then you did have close contact with probably a lot of patients before you got the positive test.
Fortunately, I went into quarantine as well with my husband on that Friday. I had my last day of work was that Friday the 13th.
Oh.
And I had a negative test on that day. This is also what we think, you know, it makes very likely that it was from being in contact with my husband Friday night, Saturday, that we, that makes it more likely that that was the positive case that we got the virus from. Because after that, I didn't see, I wasn't in contact with anybody since Friday the 13th.
Great.
Since after, yeah, it was really, really fortunate. It was partly knowing that we were high risk to be, you know, spreaders, and also what was.
Boy, you go. That's really great news. So what then happened for in terms of contact tracing? Did, because you went into quarantine right away, you probably didn't have an association with a lot of other people, so there weren't a lot of people that you were in contact with?
Yep, exactly. We were really fortunate that we didn't have to report any known contact, you know, any contacts that we were in with. Yeah, and we were, there weren't any people we were in contact with during that period. Sorry, my brain's a little foggy.
Yeah, well, you're into this for a week, and I can see the results. I mean, I can see what you're going through in a way. It makes it more. I don't want to get this. Let me just put it that way. You look like you're still having a fairly hard time.
Yeah, I don't wish this on anyone, and we probably have mild, you know, it's a fairly mild case, but I know people in Kodiak that are much sicker and, you know, needing higher level care in the ICU. So it is, and I mean, the more cases I read, it's just like, you just don't know. Like, it could have been bad for me. It could have, you know, we're not still out of the woods as far as knowing how our respiratory system and our immune system is going to respond. So it is definitely deserves respect. And on one hand, it's nice, you know, I hope that we just get through it and then we can say, hey, we have immunity for who knows how long. There are, you know, reinfection, more and more cases of reinfection occurring, but that's the best case scenario. And we're hoping for that, but it's not guaranteed.
Well, isn't the 5 to 7 day period after you first start showing symptoms, that's kind of the danger zone?
Yeah.
As to whether or not it's going to go south?
Exactly. If you make it through a week, you have pretty good chances that you're going to recover well. And around a week is when people start to develop, you know, if they're going to have the respiratory distress symptoms, that's when they start to develop, you know, the shortness of breath, the burning in their lungs, difficulty breathing, the rest of the really dangerous symptoms.
Yeah. So prior to you actually going into quarantine, had you actually started to see patients with these more severe symptoms start coming into town?
I think around, yeah, we were just starting to see our case numbers go up around a week ago in Kodiak. And definitely, like, at the time we tested positive, we learned of 10 other people that tested positive at the same time that we know. You know, right before this, it had just been, you know, numbers. But now it's like a neighbor family, several friends, another friend who is a pilot in Bethel, and Bethel, you know, has a high number of cases now. And I think some of the pilots there are starting, I mean, being a pilot is a high risk profession because you're going to be in that enclosed space with someone who, at this point, the increasing likelihood of having COVID, you know, the longer we go, the more chances that more people around us are going to have COVID. And that's exactly what we're seeing. And also remember too, that the really sick critical care, and unfortunately, I don't even want to say this, but fatality rates follow behind increasing case numbers.
So we've seen seriously increasing numbers for the last week here in town.
Yeah, we've had, I think yesterday was 13 cases. Not a lot of activity over the weekend, but 14 cases on the 21st, or maybe that was Saturday, right. 16 cases on the 20th. 9 cases on the 19th. We're in the double digits more consistently now. And I want to also just say that does not count a lot of the people that actually have COVID. My husband's not in those numbers because basically once you have symptoms and you are a contact of a known positive, they just say don't bother getting tested. And I'm not 100% sure, I need to check with the EOC, but I don't think that those are, I think the positives are only the positive test results. So I know several people that haven't gotten a positive test result, but have, like my husband, was sick with very similar symptoms to me and had a positive case. But yeah, anyway. So, well, what I really mean by that is the numbers are not reflecting the actual incident, the prevalence of COVID in our community right now. It's higher than what the numbers are showing.
What are you actually saying? Are you saying that testing before was to identify how many positives we had in the community? Now you're saying we're going to test you to see whether or not you're negative just so that we don't know whether you're going to spread it to somebody? I mean, in other words, they're just making an assumption, right, that your husband has COVID without a positive test to check it into the count that would give us a higher number, right?
Yeah, so what I'm saying, sorry, I'm not being very clear, but a lot of the people I know haven't had a positive, a lot of the people that I know likely have COVID because they're in a household with members that have it and they have the same symptoms, have not had a positive test. And I'm not 100% sure, I need to check with EOC, but I think right now we're only reporting, the numbers are only reflecting positive tests.
Right.
They're not necessarily reflecting people who are presumed positive based on symptoms and contact. I'm not sure about that. I need to check into that, but
Well, your situation gives you a perfect, we talked about this at length in times in the past, but you know, you're in that dilemma where you're faced with how do you isolate yourself from somebody who's positive so that you don't get it in a small household?
Yeah.
You know, is it possible? I mean,
yes.
We've heard that you have to separate and you have to use a separate bathroom. But how do you deal with food and how do you deal with everything else that you have to deal with? It's almost inevitable that you're going to get it.
Yeah. The CDC and Johns Hopkins have really good guidelines about what to do. And basically it is, it's to use a separate bathroom, lock. I mean, what I read several cases where the partner within the household did not get COVID. You know, they were able to get their significant other through the virus and clear of the virus. And the partner never got it, but they were extremely, they wore masks. They disinfected every single knob that the person might ever touch going on their way to the bathroom. They had a situation where they could actually have that person isolate in their own room, preferably own bathroom. If you only have a shared bathroom, you know, disinfect the toilet seat, disinfect the knobs, disinfect the sink, wash your hands frequently. Like you have to be extremely, extremely, extremely careful in that kind of situation. Always wear a mask when you're in the same airspace. As long as you're sharing an airspace with somebody, that's the most likely route of transmission. Just breathing it in from them. So wearing an N95 mask and making sure it fits, you know, all the way around your face. There's no gaps. Those are that's really the only way that, you know, you're low enough risk to not get the virus from somebody else if you're in the same house.
That's a pretty hard situation when you're dealing with somebody that you love who's in the same house with you and, you know, they're having a really, now, comparatively, I'm assuming sometime in your past you've had the flu. Is this similar to the flu?
Yeah. It's a really bad flu. Actually, in my past I've had malaria, and I would say malaria is definitely worse than COVID, but there was times when it was reminiscent of it with the body aches and the chills and just the fever and feeling awful. Like, I think I was, you know, on a scale of 0 to 100%, 100% so you're feeling great, 0 is you're dead. I was probably around a 70% as far as just feeling really awful, if that helps at all. Whereas malaria might have been more like a 50%.
That's great. Well, let's talk a little bit about what's happening in the world in the United States. Things are just seemingly out of hand. In Alaska, we keep hearing warning signals from just about every corner. And on a local level, we have a mask mandate with some fairly stern reminders that came out of our local EOC the other day. So I imagine you have a lot of time to read these days, huh?
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. So globally, I mean, COVID is skyrocketing in so many countries now, including Italy, you know, countries that were already really hard hit. Obviously, India, Brazil are up there right behind the United States. In the United States, we are still in the lead as far as number of cases and number of deaths. But right, we are breaking records every day in the United States. We're over 20,000 new cases per day. In March, at the highest, is around 37,000 new cases per day, and that, you know, unthinkable. And then in July, we had that new peak where it was like 70,000+ cases per day, and that was, you know, crazy. We wish we were at those stages right now. I mean, over 200,000 per cases per day, and exponentially growing. It's going to be, pretty soon we're going to look back and be like, 200,000 cases per day was small compared to, you know, where we're at in the future. Over 2,000, we're starting to see over 2,000 deaths per day in the United States. We're back up to those high numbers that, you know, were at our earlier peaks earlier this year. And we're on the exponential curve for all these things, all these measures. Alaska yesterday, we had a record number of deaths for our state, with 13 deaths in the state of Alaska, 583 new cases. And we're on the rise. Kodiak, we're on the rise too. I know we talked about that. Medevacs are getting short. You know, there's a lot of resources in the state that are starting to get strained that we are also dependent on in Kodiak. And so, I know we've said this every show, but now is the time where we have to stop sharing airspaces, is the bottom line. The way that this transmits is through shared airspaces. And until we stop, you know, limit that as much as possible, it's, we're going to just keep spreading it.
Doesn't seem to be happening though.
It, unfortunately, it doesn't. I think, yeah, with pandemic fatigue and now the holidays, the winter months, just being indoors with more people, I mean, traveling, it's not happening enough, and we're headed towards the worst public health crisis that the United States has seen since 1918 1919. This is kind of from, you know, what Dr. Osterholm mentioned in his most recent podcast. We're headed towards a really dangerous place in our country for unfortunately morbidity and mortality from this. Not to be doom and gloom around the holidays, but to really, you know, if you don't have to travel, don't travel. If you, all the decisions we make right now are super critical, and we do have, there is something we can do about this. Like if you, you know, if each person isolates themselves, the virus will not have a way to transmit to that next person. And that's just what we have to do at this point. I saw somewhere that said, a Zoom Thanksgiving is better than an ICU Christmas.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of public health officials, the New Mexico governor was very on point. She said, choosing to spend Thanksgiving with your family this year could very well cause a fatality in your family. It's highly likely at this point that, you know, the more people that go see their family for Thanksgiving, the more fatalities are going to come from that. And you know, when you think about it that way, like, nobody wants that. I think, yeah, just being able to sacrifice it just this one year, just for now.
Well, we're close to a point where this vaccines are going to be available to us. You know,
yes.
Now they're talking somewhere around April, you know, that it's going to be available to a lot of people by January, February, maybe, but with the bulk of people being able to get a vaccine by April or May.
Exactly. Yeah. If we could just hold out till then, if we could just hold off on, you know, visiting each other until more people can get the vaccine. But you're right. Spring is when it will be more likely available to the broader public. You probably know the timeline. They're hoping Pfizer is having a conversation with FDA about getting emergency use authorization. I think the date was December 10th or sometime in early December now. And then if they do get approval, they will release 50 to 64 million vaccines, which will be distributed to the states based on population size.
Which means we get nothing.
I mean, we are going to get a very small number of vaccines, if any. And also, the other important thing is it's a two-dose vaccine separated by 1 month. So that, you know, really it's half the number of full vaccinations that, you know, 64 million is 32 million people that actually get a full vaccine. And the efficacy that they studied, it's 94% effective from their studies. 90 to 95%, their numbers first came out 90 and then 95%, 94% for people that are 65 and older. But it's going to take those two doses to reach that effectiveness. So
really, so one dose doesn't do you anything. So in other words, if you're in, let's assume, you know, there's not a whole lot of this that comes to Alaska originally, and the governor and Dr. Zink are probably going to have to decide, you know, what's the priority? Is it the medical profession or is it the senior citizens or people at really high risk? That's kind of an ethical quandary to put you into, you know, whether
the Alaska vaccination distribution plan from at least from October does, you know, say healthcare workers, essential healthcare workers, and, you know, the higher the risk will be the first people to receive the vaccine. And then second are the assisted living and emergency medical settings. And then third is going to be the higher risk. And then after that, the general population. I will say with that first batch of vaccines, we're not even going to be able to probably vaccinate all of the healthcare workers in. I mean, I'm not sure. I don't have the numbers at all. I don't think anyone has the numbers. It was actually just released, I think yesterday, Alex Azar, the secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services for the U.S., said, you know, we're just going to distribute based on population size of states. And that is a new development. Before, they were going to try to, you know, make sure that all that federally it was kind of regulated from who is going to get priority, healthcare workers, high risk patients, all the way down. But he said, we just want to keep it simple. And anyway, so I'm not sure. I don't think at this point, because this is such a new development, I don't know what number each state is going to get, but just looking at the numbers, I don't think there's going to be enough to even cover the first round of people who get, you know, the healthcare providers in the.
Well, we are kind of almost blessed in that, you know, it looks like three of them are going to get approved right away, you know, and the government apparently has been making millions of these doses. Then it's, you get into a distribution problem, but, you know, here, potentially, you could be getting three different vaccines all delivered to Alaska, all with different, you know, rules about how they're going to be distributed and how you have to administer them to people and how you have to store them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is going to be interesting. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And then, you know, collecting data on which ones are effective in the broader population. But yeah, Moderna is the second one, and it is hoping to. It's closely behind Pfizer, and Pfizer is working with BioNTech, which is a German company. So Germany gets half the doses, and the U.S. gets half the doses, and there's 12.5 million doses that will be made in their first batch. But yeah, and then so they're both mRNA vaccines. I know you guys talked about this a little bit on the last show, which was excellent. Dr. Jones did a great job. And both of them are two doses about a month apart. I know you guys mentioned Moderna needs to be stored at minus 20 degrees Celsius, which is minus 4 degrees Fahrenheit, which is a really reasonable cold storage temperature. Other vaccines are more in line with that cold temperature. And then Pfizer needs to be stored at minus 70 degrees Celsius or minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit, which is going to be a lot trickier. They're on dry ice. The dry ice needs to be replaced every 5 days, and they can only be opened a certain amount of time. And the reason why, you know, these vaccines at this point need to be stored so cold is just their messenger RNA vaccines. Basically, the vaccine puts RNA, which is like DNA, the instructions for life from the virus into our cells, and then our cells make take those little instructions and make antigens that are viral antigens, and then they create an immune response to those antigens. So you get, it's really strong, you know, fortified immunity, because it's like your body's kind of making this thing that it needs to then mount an immune response towards. But messenger RNA is more fragile and can break down easily. Cold temperatures prevent the breakdown of those RNA chains.
So this, I want to ask you now, kind of goes into with your situation, but we had a listener who asked whether or not vaccine would be available to somebody who has already had COVID.
That is an excellent question, and I don't know the answer to that yet. I did read a little bit about, you know, other people have asked that same question, and doctors say eventually probably yes, but not, this is just speculation, but not likely at first. You probably won't be in the first pool of people to be able to get the vaccine, because the whole point of the vaccine is herd immunity. And if someone has already had the virus, they probably have somewhat of an immune system response anyways. And so, you know, the point is to protect the people who don't have any immune system response yet.
Which,
eventually, though, I think it will be available to everybody who wants it, regardless of if you've had it before or not, like the flu shot.
Well, that's kind of an interesting ethical issue with how we're testing people then. Now, if we're telling people we're going to make an assumption that you're positive and not prove it by, let's put you in your husband's situation, you know, you may decide because your vaccine is limited that you're going to distribute it. In other words, you'd still be eligible for a vaccine even if you had a positive test, but you don't have any proof of it because nobody tested you at the time.
Yeah, well, if you don't have a positive test, you're more eligible. I mean, you're probably even more eligible if you meet the criteria. You know, if you're a healthcare provider, high risk person, if you have never had it and have never had a test, then you're probably more likely to get it than someone who, like me, already had it and has a positive test. Someone also asked, you know, if they're going to require antibody testing before the vaccine. And I haven't seen anything about that, but I think it's a good idea. For example, for me as a healthcare provider, if they, you know, just triaging who's going to get the vaccine, if they tested me and I had antibodies towards COVID, it would make sense that I don't need the vaccine yet, compared to, you know, if it's going to be between me and another healthcare provider has never had the virus and doesn't have antibodies,
right,
then I think it would make sense that it goes to that other healthcare provider before me. And then eventually when more vaccines come out and it's not a limited quantity, then I would take the vaccine as well. From the studies so far, it's shown to be extremely effective and, as you know, safe. Yes, it does cause minor, they don't even want to call them side effects. They want to call them immune response. Because basically, you get really mild, you know, flu-like symptoms from, a lot of people are getting mild.
You're not having a side effect. You're having an immune response.
That's exactly right. And that really is what's happening physiologically. Your body is mounting an immune response to these new viral antigens that have been made in your cells.
Uh-huh.
From the vaccine. So, I mean, technically that is really what it is. And I think, but I think that no matter what, it's important that people know, because it's a two dose vaccine. And because of the symptoms that people are having from the first dose, they're worried that they won't come back for that second dose. And so as healthcare providers, I think it's really important that we say, yes, there are going to be, you know, side effects or symptoms, whatever you want to call it. You're going to feel crummy after you get the virus.
Who cares? You're not going to die. I mean, that's the, you know,
exactly. When you weigh those, you know, minor cold symptoms compared to the potential life-threatening, severe, serious illnesses, comorbidities that you can get from having the virus, I would hands down take the vaccine any day. And all of the epidemiologists and virologists that I trust are all weighing in and saying, you know, I would take this vaccine. And they were very cautious. They said, we don't want to rush this process. If the vaccine doesn't look safe, we're not going to, you know, put our stamp of approval on it. So I think it's really encouraging. I think this administration and Operation Warp Speed has done an incredible job getting the vaccine out to people for all the bumps and I would say failures that we have had in managing the coronavirus from a public health standpoint. This is really, really incredible news, and it's encouraging. It is definitely something to look forward to.
Well, if they're at this in phase three now, and everybody's making an assumption that the virus is going to get approved, or the vaccine is going to get approved here quickly, what are they waiting for? I mean, what's left in the trials that they need to accomplish? I mean, if they've already warp speeded through to this point, why not just take a chance and go for it? I mean, imagine there'd be some legal issues there, but
yeah, I think the FDA needs to review all the data, and what I've read, and you know, make sure that, because when they sign off on it, they're signing off on a really big deal, and they don't want to get it wrong.
Right.
You know, if they're reviewing the data, if there is any kind of, I mean,
you don't want people to have to question whether or not they're rushing this through.
Exactly. Exactly. Research. It's really important just to make sure the research is solid, that their numbers are really accurate, that there hasn't been any data that, you know, got thrown out because it wasn't what looked good or what they wanted, or, you know, there's always, I think most scientists are very above, you know, they want to just have the facts, have the truthful information. But when there's a lot of money on the line, you know, things get, medications have been looked very promising, and then once they are really closely evaluated, are shown to maybe not be as great as the company wanted them to look. So, and I'm not saying that's happening, but I think the important thing is that the process, the FDA does need to go through that review process very carefully and make really sound decisions, because this is what the general population is going to find out, and it's really important that they have accurate information up front, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, there are some, just within the last week, the FDA has approved a couple of different drugs for treatment now. They're still actively trying to come up with different treatment protocols for the people who do get this prior to them coming up with a vaccine, right?
So, yeah.
So what do we know about the two things that got approved?
As far as treatments go?
Yeah. There's some antivirals that were just recently given an approval.
Yeah, you know, I was just reviewing those. I don't have that.
Okay, we'll do it on the next show.
Perfect, yeah. I know there's a couple of new ones, and I honestly saw that news, and I haven't looked deeper into exactly what's available yet.
You've been kind of busy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I've had time to read, but honestly, with the symptoms, I haven't read that much until the last couple of days.
No. Usually it's just Buffy the Vampire or something. You just let go. Deal. Well, for our local medical community, though, you're out of the picture for 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. How much can our local community absorb from, you know, if 10% of our medical community goes down, how much of a load? Because it already seemed like there was a big load on the medical community to begin with, even before COVID started. It seemed like we had just enough people to kind of do the business of the town.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think I mean, the hospital doesn't have much room for having people out sick. They're kind of staffed for what they need and not much more than, without much more than that. And yeah, I'm out for 2 weeks. And in the clinic, it's a little bit easier. You can reschedule people, other people can kind of help pick up the slack a little bit. But if you start having more providers, there's you just don't have enough coverage. One at a time is okay, it is what it is, but at multiple people at a time, it's going to take a toll on how many patients can be seen. The other providers are filling in, working a lot harder. I will tell you, the healthcare providers in the lower 48, I'm on several groups, physician groups on Facebook, and some of them are getting so burnt out now. They're working double shifts, they're exhausted, they're dealing with sick patients. And when I see that, it makes, it kind of like makes me double down on my resolve to make sure that we don't get there in this community, because that is, we just don't have the resources to handle that. We don't have the capacity to really manage that. And yeah, I mean, our hospital, our inpatient unit, emergency services, and the ICU unit here, and our medevacs are all there. It won't take much to overwhelm that. We have what we need, during normal times. We don't have a high reserve for much more than that.
Well, we keep hearing the crunch on the system throughout Alaska, that already you're seeing critical shortages in the medical community in Anchorage, and bed space is getting crunched. And I continually keep hearing the word diversion. It's being used in the lower 48 a lot, but in Alaska, it's now the diversion from resources from rural communities in particular, which means that this plan that Kodiak had about taking critical patients and moving them to Anchorage and get them out of the local hospital, that might not be an option that's available.
It's I'm not sure the latest for what Kodiak is planning as far as, if we do have a surge. But yeah, it there's gonna have to be, if we can't keep it under wraps, there's going to have to be some overload mechanism, or some like unloading mechanism, offloading mechanism. I mean, look at Texas, and they're, opening up different offloading sites where patients can go that is not the hospital, because the hospitals are full and overflowing. I mean, their morgues are full and overflowing.
Well, they may have the infrastructure to do that in Anchorage, but we don't have the infrastructure
No.
to do it here. So
And again, it's not even space, it's providers,
it's
that is,
people, right?
it's people, yeah, and skilled people. So respiratory therapists, critical care docs, and the medications that you need to, we talked about this one once before, but just like intubating patients, you need a lot of different resources. And yeah, we don't have much here.
It's almost to the end. What would you suggest to alleviate symptoms if you do get COVID? Any is there anything over the counter that works?
Yeah, that's a great question. So keep taking vitamin D3, 5,000 units a day, zinc 25 to 50 milligrams a day, vitamin C 1,000 milligrams a day, and drink lots of water, like 3 liters of fluids a day, and sleep. And if you can't, oh, ibuprofen and Tylenol are both safe and helpful for, like, body aches, fever, chills. Ibuprofen is safe. I did another, but when I got this, I did another review of what's the latest evidence. Ibuprofen is okay to take. And then if you can't sleep, a sleep aid, Unisom. And if that's not over the counter sleep aids, like melatonin, Unisom, Doxylamine, Benadryl, things like that. If you can't sleep, you can ask your doctor for something to help sleep, because sleep is critical. And I will tell you, I couldn't sleep for 2 days with the symptoms, because my headache was so severe that I couldn't sleep. So ended up taking something a little bit stronger to help sleep, and or and nausea medicine. So if you have the GI symptoms, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, Zofran, your doctor can prescribe you something for the nausea. And it's really just symptomatic care, but there are medications that can help with symptoms. And if you feel like they're more than what you can kind of get through without help, just talk to your doctor about what they can prescribe, obviously through telemedicine.
Well, I wish you the very best, and I hope the next time I see your smiling face that you're feeling a little bit better, and that we're doing a lot better as a community, that we make it through this Thanksgiving holiday without seeing increased numbers all over the place.
Yeah, thank you. I completely agree.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving.
All right, and to all of you, thanks for being with us again today. Have a fine day. Bye.